I'm Dan Hartnett, and I'm a professor at Kenyon College. Whenever I'm socializing with my colleagues, I inevitably end up asking them questions about the fascinating research they do. I thought other people might be interested in our conversations, too. So I decided to start a podcast to ask Kenyon faculty about their research, their fields, and how they get students involved. This is the Kenyon College Profcast. My guest today is Dr. Celso M. Villegas. Celso is a cultural sociologist who studies the relationship between the middle class and democracy. He writes on middle class movements around the world, from Venezuela to the Philippines to South Korea, and recently published an op-ed on the election night acceptance speech of Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. I sat down with Celso in December of 2018. Celso, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Dan. Appreciate it.
So you're a cultural sociologist. What are some of the big questions your field asks?
So cultural sociologists are interested in meaning, right, and how deeply infused our lives are with symbols, ideas, values, to understand the world that's around us, right? How we attach meaningful events in our lives to emotions, how we understand our relationships to other people, and we mediate those with symbols and ideas, values, language, narratives, all that sort of stuff.
And how does that relate to other fields in sociology?
Well, we're a big tent discipline, right? We do quantitative work, that is, we work very closely with surveys and collect data. We do ethnography, where we investigate very deeply people's lived experiences in their lives as they're acting them out. And some of us do archival analysis, where we look at old documents and try to piece together the meanings and structures that existed in the past. And so cultural sociology is really sort of a part of all of those things in some ways.
Is there a big divide between sociologists who work in more quantitative ways and ones who work in more qualitative ways?
Well, there are political divides, let's say, between quantitative and qualitative work. I developed an appreciation for quantitative work. A lot of my friends in graduate school are demographers. They work on census data and they collect their own data through surveys. And, you know, to the degree to which quantitative and qualitative work oppose each other, it's really friendly opposition in sociology. I think other disciplines are worse at it, dealing with that kind of conflict. But we have a good working relationship.
The central question of your research is the relationship between democracy and the middle class, described it.
Yeah.
Could you explain briefly how you see them relating to each other, just as a basis for further conversation?
Yeah, so there are three traditional ways that folks have tried to connect the middle class to democracy, right? So there's the classic Aristotelian way, where the middle class is a sufficient condition for democracy. If you have one, it will, in the long run, give you a democratic country. So policymakers in the 50s and 60s sort of imagined this as a development strategy, and they advocated for the development of middle classes around the world, either through consumption, through belief, through economic policy and industrialization, with the idea that in the long run, when you develop a broad middle class, it'll stabilize society. The problem with that is that empirically in the 60s and 70s, you saw a lot of military coups in Latin America and in East Asia supported by self-described middle class people or middle income people. And so the model was thrown off a little bit during that period. And there developed a new sort of argument about middle classes being really bad for democracy. Some folks say, like Samuel Huntington back in the 60s, argued that middle class people are overeducated. They generate ideas that are way too utopian for the context in which they exist. And they foment revolution. And so that's also bad for democracy. So we sort of broke off from that classic Aristotelian argument, sort of Aristotle plus capitalism gets you democracy. And then we moved towards these arguments that said the middle class was not good for democracy. So the thing that sort of threw the curveball to that argument was in the early 80s through the 1990s, we had a lot of transitions from authoritarianism to democracy, where the middle class played another amazing role, right? It came to the streets, it protested. In the cases that I studied, the Philippines, especially with the People Power Movement, where it was attributed that a middle class that had been previously sort of dormant rose up, understood itself as an important actor, and that advocated for democracy. Scholars are trying to figure out, well, what is it that makes a middle class in one instance support democracy, another instance reject it, right, and then support it again? And they happened on this argument that I call the rationalist argument, that middle income or middle occupation people really do think about their self-interest. They want to be included in a political and economic system, but they'll pick sides. And if the working class or elites are stronger politically or economically, they'll switch sides based on what those other classes do. It doesn't really capture their meaning. It doesn't really explain how they understand the physical objects, the things they buy, why they're meaningful to them. It doesn't explain the kinds of political alliances that they make, right? Or why other classes might observe the middle class and say, this is a worthwhile ally. right? How do we understand them? One way to rethink this is to think about how people broadly, how societies broadly define the middle class and how they understand it, and how the broad definition, as it's sort of worked out in politics, in the media, in fictional media, in factual media like newspapers and magazines, how folks try to imagine the definition of that thing. Is it a worthwhile ally or not? Is it something that represents the entirety of society or only a portion of it?
How do you think you approach this differently than maybe a political scientist when you're approaching democracy and the middle class?
Really, the difference between sociology and political science on this point is that we have a very different sense of what rationality is, sort of traditionally distinct perspective on what makes people rational. We argue, or we have argued since one of our founders, Max Weber, that people can be means ends rational. We also argue, or have argued, that people are value rational. We also have argued that human beings act because their action is traditional, that there's a habit. The sort of holy grail of sociological theory, in some sense, is try to put all those in one package. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to do. And then you can imagine how, on the one hand, being means ends rational, utilitarian, and driven by your feelings, and thinking about the social context in your end, and thinking about yourself as an individual, right? That if we were to pick one of those, you'd get a really good specific answer. But the holy grail is, can we put all this together and imagine human action as being fully formed like this, that we're self-reflective, we take culture into account, we understand other people, we want to make ourselves individually active? So that's the hard part, right? And I think that's where the sociologists and the political science divide, and that we try to imagine that humans' actions are a lot more complex to that degree.
How quickly is our understanding of the relationship between democracy and the middle class changing?
One thing that's really interesting about teaching this is that you can always call back to sort of that perennial and classic question about from Aristotle, introduce historical evidence to suggest that that might not be accurate, and then historical evidence suggests that it might be accurate, and place it in sort of sequence and have students sort of think through whether or not the middle class supports or doesn't support democracy. And because it sort of doesn't have a definitive answer to some degree, it's really fun to teach. And I think, too, where lots of students and a lot of Americans imagine themselves as middle class, it is, in some sense, an identity-forming question. Luckily, stuff from the 20th century is still pretty valid. We're only 10 years or so, 20 years or so in the 21st century, so there's always new stuff that's happening, but we can always couch it in those classic questions.
Why is it important for us to know about the relationship between democracy and the middle class?
In some sense, from an abstract perspective, we can treat this like a social science question and say, well, you know, this is a fascinating instance of sort of the empirical world. There are people with middle incomes, people who are in the middle of an economic structure in terms of their production. There are people who consume particular products that we sort of understand to be middle class, right? And to think about that set and their political proclivities is a fascinating sort of way to try to understand the modern world. Another way to think about this is from the sort of a normative and philosophical perspective. Aristotle was talking about the middle class back in Greece. There's new histories that talk about middling groups or middle sectors or middle orders, right? Where a lot of the same cultural descriptions are similar in terms of their political proclivities, right? About stability or about instability, about radicalism or not being radical. It produces something that's important to us. We want to know how to order our political lives, and we want to know where our position is in them, right? And that a good number of people over centuries have imagined themselves to be middle class, and that political pundits have imagined this entity is really important, right? We should try to figure out why they do that, and what meaning it has for how they create the societies they want.
Is it possible to measure how democratic a society is? What factors would you look at for that?
Measuring democracy is an interesting question. I think part of it is, here's where we work really closely with political scientists, try to innovate new techniques either through surveys or qualitative work to sort of get a sense of people's support for democracy, how they understand it, and why it's meaningful to their lives, right? And anthropologists also do this too, which is, I think, really fascinating. We should think really abstractly in some sense. Is democracy a feature of how people imagine what is good, right? So we can ask people about their values, what they think a political system should be if it reflects their cultural values. We can think about democracy at an institutional level, right? What are the components of a democratic polity? Right? It should have free and fair elections, right? It should have alternative sources of information. It should have regularized sort of handovers of power. It should have full inclusion of all adults. And I think it's also important, and lots of sociology, anthropology, political science try to get at how people live democracy in their lives, right? What is the meaning of being able to vote, right? Why has it been so such a passionate topic that has motivated social movements? So there's a lot of ways to cut it. And there's lots of debates about what's the most effective, the most expedient, the most true, the most accurate definition. So not a definitive answer to you folks out there, but I think it's one of these things where one answer is going to lead to another possible answer, right? And we're not fighting each other over these questions. We're trying to work with each other.
How do you go about defining middle class in your work? What's the nature of the definition, and how is it that it comes together for you?
The first thing you're supposed to do if you do class analysis is really define this entity, right? Where is it located in systems of production or in systems of consumption, right? So you try to look at either income or occupation or the kinds of things or frequencies at which people consume particular objects versus others. So when I started out my dissertation work, I was trying to figure out these sort of awkward protests that on the one hand seemed democratic, on the other hand sort of infirm democracy. The first task was, how do you define the middle class? In all three of the countries that I study, Venezuela, the Philippines, Ecuador, there are commonalities, but they're not the same definition. In the Philippines, for instance, when folks say middle class or the political designation middle forces, they also include people from the Catholic Church, and they also include sort of good oligarchs in there too. So President Corazon Aquino, her son, they're good rich people, right? So they're in that set of middle class. When I was conducting field work in the Philippines, I was talking to a senior scholar in the field, and I asked about some of my own family members who own businesses. So my aunt employed 20 people at a bakery. And so I asked the scholar, well, that means my aunt's a capitalist, not middle class. And she said, no, your aunt's a middle class person because she has middle class values. And so this sort of moral dimension never really popped up in sort of the strict class analysis work that I'd been doing before. And this pops up over and over again in the cases that I studied. I went out to scholars in Venezuela and Ecuador, stayed with families, did research in libraries. And even the archivists would say, well, you better study the middle class now. It's disappearing, or it doesn't exist. And so in some sense, coming up with the definition was a fun sort of exercise. In some ways, it was trying to figure out what people meant by what middle class was. So there's this great study done in the early 70s in Venezuela where a team of scholars in the U.S. and Venezuelan go and ask people in Venezuela. The question says in Spanish, there's a lot being said about classes in this day and age. To what class do you come from? ¿Qué clase pertenece usted? And the response to the survey was 57% of Venezuelans in 1973 said they were middle class. Okay. And Venezuela was, we might define it in sort of older terms, it was a developing country. And the survey researchers wrote in a note, this can't possibly be right. You can't have more than half of this country say it's middle class when the structural conditions on the ground don't reflect this. So self-definition doesn't really catch up in that regard, too. Americans, according to the more recent Pew surveys, I think is about 44% of them will self-identify as middle class. That number fluctuates from 46 to 44, but that's a lot of folks, right? And our income distribution in the U.S. is really skewed. Both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders defined middle class as any family that was making anywhere between, I believe it was on the low end, $50,000 a year to $250,000 a year. And $250,000 a year, that's getting in the top 4% of the income spectrum. So imagining the people at either end sharing the same lifestyle is complicated, right? It became, in some sense, a puzzle to try to figure out, well, which of these is the right answer? This is where I turn to the historians of all people to try to figure this out. And there's a lot of good recent history that try to figure out how historically societies had defined or understood the middle class. And it became more fascinating to me to try to understand why that term or that the idea of a clase media or the middle class was imbued with different occupations at one point in time and not in another point in time. In the case of Venezuela, before 2002, folks would talk actively about a politically engaged middle class. And then afterwards, it was almost as if you called yourself middle class, then it was almost like a political kiss of death. So it's sort of a fascinating way in which societies moved away from the term, came back to it. And so I thought that it would be very interesting to figure out how the definition changes over time, right? So I take a step back, I guess, from all those quantitative and ideological definitions of class and try to say, well, what is it about the way in which human beings have tried to describe this term? And what are the ways in which they process this idea through media, through the ways in which they assign certain objects to middle-class life? What do those things represent? And there's fascinating patterns that appear if you look at the question that way, ones that really, in some sense, connect middle classes around the world in ways that we didn't really expect to see.
And what are some of those connecting points?
There are really sort of really influential moral binaries that, in some sense, perennially across localities, people in media, people in academic writing, politicians, self-defined middle-class people themselves would use to try to figure out their place in the world. And it would be things like backwards and progressive, or backwards and modern. It would be decent and indecent, narcissistic or ascetic or indulgent. These pairings pop up frequently across cases, across time. We sort of fill these terms with different categories, right? We might say a middle class that owns a house is decent, and ones that don't are not decent. They're insecure, right? Folks whose incomes are declining are insecure, and those who have stable incomes are secure. Whereas another period in time, we might say, well, home ownership's not all that important. So whether or not you owned a factory, or whether or not you sent your kids to a certain school. And what stayed similar, despite the fact that the content of who was being defined by these terms was different, was that the terms stayed the same over time. And those terms happen over and over again. They appear in the U.S., they appear in the Philippines, they appear in 19th century Peru, they appear in England in the 15th century. Like, they're consistent. The middle class that was subsumed underneath them is different.
Do you find these terms jumping out at you now if you're reading a newspaper or watching some mass media?
Yeah, so one of the fascinating things is that we typically assume that these terms will appear, let's say, if we take a strict sort of materialist or structuralist perspective, that as economic change happens, then we're going to start seeing people being described as decent, right, or that comfortable. Okay, but those are terms that are not necessarily just associated with economic development, right? There are terms that are seen in the domestic sphere. There are terms that are associated with people with moral character, broadly defined.
Propriety is what I think about with decency a lot of the time.
Yeah, being proper, being respectable. These are terms that appear quite consistently to define a middle class that's good. And the advantage of looking at the language of decency is that it's creative, that folks will apply it in one instance or another to different people. They think about it critically. We see decency, respectability, politics referred to in quotes, right? Ironically. And in some sense, it suggests that people are very much aware of what these terms do, right, in regards to their position to other people and their reflections in regards to sort of how they position themselves against other classes or how they want to see themselves. And they know that they have a particular power that may judge them as sacred or profane. And so to characterize something as quote-unquote decent or quote-unquote comfortable or quote-unquote normal takes that moral power out of it a bit. And so you can step back and say, well, oh, no, I'm not decent. If anything, I might be the opposite of that. And that might be a good thing, right, in this time period.
For as flexible as the term is, do you feel as if you have a particular perspective on the contemporary middle class in the U.S. right now? That is to say, are there particular values that you would ascribe to the middle class in the U.S. as we live it today?
Yeah, I mean, we tell a very particular story here in the U.S. about the middle class, right? It's one, at least in the 20th century, where we associate the 50s with the ideal middle class life. It's materially comfortable. It's the efflorescence of consumer life. There's new products, things that define ourselves as, you know, having this particular brand in your house and having a politics that was stable and where people were quote unquote respected each other, et cetera, et cetera. In some sense, a lot of American sociology was built on this image that this was an functional society, we argued, and that as we moved into the 60s and 70s, economic decline, the development of new social movements challenged this ideal sense of what middle-class people were like or what an ideal society would be like. And we tell a story now about middle-class decline, right, that we associate with the decline of unions, with the decline of government, with the rise of racism or hidden forms of racism in the 60s and 70s after the civil rights movement. There's a parallel that you can see in the U.S. and that maybe even though our particular history is different, the way in which we imagine the middle class and try to get around it and try to use the middle class as an idea in our politics is actually fairly similar.
How has your training and knowledge as a sociologist helped you to understand aspects of your everyday life? I mean, you live here in Mount Vernon, right, and you've lived in other places too. I mean, do you maybe have a different experience when you're in Kroger and you're shopping alongside people than I would as somebody who hasn't studied nearly as much sociology?
So, you know, I love Kroger. Shout out hashtag Kroger. I mean, shopping is sort of a fascinating experience for me in lots of ways, maybe middle class experience, right? But, you know, sociologists think about society in this in a way where we're trying to use the sociological imagination. And we think about the position of your biography, your structure, and your history, right? And so I've arrived here in Ohio, having lived in California and in Rhode Island. My path has led me here in some sense because of my job here at Kenyon College. I live in Mount Vernon, Ohio, which is lots of evidence of rural inequality. And yet I shop at a Kroger that has a really nice organic food section, which is, according to people who live in Columbus, is a lot better than the ones that you see in Kroger's in Columbus. And so, you know, in some sense, I sort of walk through there and I'm wondering, well, what is it that I'm doing here that's reproducing my social class, right? That I can buy these objects and imagine, well, I live in a city too, right? That if I buy this particular product, maybe that gives me a sense of connection to people who live in, live on the coast or live in the major urban hub, right? And on the other hand, to think about my place here in Mount Vernon or in Gambier and to say, well, I do live in a rural, live in a rural place. And that if you go back to the coasts, folks will talk very negatively about the kinds of politics that are here and the kinds of people that live here. And they have overblown ideas about how folks are like. Now that, you know, that I exist here, that you sort of have to make peace with what's different, but you also imagine yourself as embedded in a system that's changing around you, and that there's a way in which you can feel like you're connected to a place, even though you might feel distant from it. One of the things I think is fascinating to think about Ohio is that way back in 2006, even before I started doing my research, I happened to watch Sherrod Brown's acceptance speech on C-SPAN. And this is, 2006 was a sort of a bumper crop year for the Democrats. And the first thing that comes out of this man's mouth is, here in middle America, the middle class won. And he kept going on and on about the middle class. I'm like, oh, wow, this is like what I'm writing about for the theory section of my dissertation. This sounds great. Someone's actually using this language to define a whole, to say that here in the heartland, there are values that are associated not with a conservative perspective of what the middle class is, but with a liberal one. And then he did it again in 2012. And so when folks, out on the East Coast or on the West Coast say there's no, the middle class in Ohio is different, there are people who are creatively imagining it as distinct.
So I should say congratulations on your op-ed published in the Columbus Dispatch recently. You know, it is about Sherrod Brown and about Sherrod Brown, acceptance speeches and such like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what your argument is in that?
Yeah, so what I think, I watched Sherrod Brown's acceptance speech this year, the night of Tuesday, November 6th of 2018. You know, compare that to his acceptance speeches in 2006 and 2012, where he begins with this statement, here in the middle of America, in Ohio, the middle class won, right? Or in this midterm election, the middle class won. These things, X, Y, Z, are an undisguised assault on the middle class. He changes the way that he begins his acceptance speech this time. He talks about progressives. Ohio is an example for the rest of the country. He talks about the dignity of work, about how he has a pin that's made from Ohio steel. He drives an Ohio Jeep. And in similar ways in other speeches, he does actually mention those things, but he doesn't personalize them the same way that he did in this speech. And I thought this was fascinating. I think that class coalitions are important. I think that they form the basis of real political change, and that Sherrod Brown, at least in my old recollection, was a sort of a champion in some sense for a very broad middle class that subsumed a lot of occupational categories that could be a moral center for the rest of the country. And here he just shifted the way he's talked about it. He's more interested in some sense talking about work, thinking that we're connected by the dignity that connects us in terms of the work that we do for different people and the things that we provide to others. And I think that's a very interesting and it's an important shift. But it's very different from the Sherrod Brown from 6 years ago and very different from the Sherrod Brown 12 years ago. And so I sort of thought about this for a second and I thought, well, what is it that he's trying to say here? Or what is he trying to do? And we're entering a phase in the political cycle where I think folks are trying to imagine how Democrats will create a national ticket that will appeal in some sense to the same broad support that the Republicans have received. And one option is to imagine Democratic candidates as part of the people and as deeply connected, personally connected. He says in his speech, this is the blueprint for the rest of the country. And that's sort of, well, I don't know, considering that he was the only one came out of the election okay. But it suggests that, maybe the maneuver here is that you have to sort of personalize yourself, connect yourself as a vehicle for the broad swaths of folks who have been forgotten, and essentially sort of play the left version of Trump on the national scale, sort of like a counter-populism, right? To look for a charismatic figure that can represent a set of folks and embody that one idea. And what was troubling to me is that Brown shifted so much from talking about the middle class in his previous campaigns to still talking about the middle class, but relegating it towards the ends of speeches and thinking about it as a technical category. I thought that was a fascinating distinction because it reminded me about the shift that happened in Venezuela after 2002. And there was a big middle class protest that tried to force Hugo Chavez out of the presidency. And it failed. Lots of stuff happened in that time period in April of 2002, but ultimately Chavez stayed in power. And it became like a political lightning rod to call yourself middle class. The opposition to Chavez said, no, no, we're not class-based. We're part of civil society. That's the term you should use to describe us. And then the government issued a report to try to figure out what had happened during 2002. And they said, no, no, no. When they say civil society, they really mean middle class. And these middle class people are out to get us. And so in that interim period, the Chavista government tried to generate support from a middle class. And they had this group called Clase Media en Positivo, positive middle class. And it said middle class people support the government. And the opposition said, this is impossible. No middle class person would ever support you. And in response, the government would say, if you say you're middle class, then you are a coup supporter, unlike these folks who support us. And it went back and forth to the point where folks really did not want to associate that label with their politics. And it changed the way that identity formation operated in Venezuela. And so for me, it's not a one-to-one correspondence, but it always concerns me here that in that case where folks didn't imagine a constituency that could be broad, that could be located apart from the extremes, however you define it, right, whatever the content of that middle class might be, that you're essentially throwing away a class that could form a coalition partner with another class. And so maybe the upside of Brown's speech is that he's going to represent work, and that there may be another Democratic candidate who will support the middle class. And you put those two things together and you get your class coalition. But it sounds like he's not going to be the one to do it, at least in the ways in which he's speaking right now.
So what are you working on right now?
So I'm working on a couple things. One is I'm finishing up some work on Ecuador and thinking about development and the different kinds of stories people tell about economic development. Another thing, I'm also working on the situation in the Philippines with Rodrigo Duterte and talking about the past 20 years of Philippine politics have exhibited what I'm describing as counter-populism. So populist leaders win elections or try to run for the presidency, and there's sort of a concerted effort to prevent that populist from winning or to kick them out of office. Yeah, and then otherwise, you know, we teach a lot here. Working on a new syllabus for next semester and thinking about ones for next year, too. So, yeah, that's also work for me and work that I enjoy doing. So, yeah, that's all that's contained in that. Yeah.
Are there questions that curious people ask you when they find out you're a sociologist?
Invariably, when someone asks me, or rather, what do you do for a living? I say I'm a sociologist, or I say that I teach sociology. And they say, oh, you must study religion. You must study this, or you must study that. And I've never gotten anyone to say specifically, like, oh, you studied democracy, you studied the middle class. So then I have to explain it. It's not a big deal, but it's sort of like, well, I guess, you know, it's nice to know that our discipline really does cover a lot of stuff, yeah, and that it's out there. But like I said before, you know, going out to the field, to Venezuela, to the Philippines, to Ecuador, folks know what sociologists do. They study political economy, that is the relationship between power and economic structures. They study meaning. They study class. They study people in different groups and how they relate to each other. And so folks know what a sociologist does. And then I say, well, I study the middle class. And they say, well, it doesn't exist. So that's usually what happens to me when people say I'm a sociologist. Otherwise, they say, okay, that's great. Next person in line. Let's talk to them instead. My family has some understanding of what it is I'm doing. And they feature in the story a little bit too. My dad's side of the family, who stayed in the Philippines, were anti-Marcos protesters in 1983. And so when I showed up to do my field work for the first time a long time ago, I said, this is my idea about the middle class. This is this particular economic group. It does these particular things because it's ambivalent to democracy. He said, no. We're not ambivalent to democracy. We support it. We always support democracy. And this is where it was like, well, here's what I've read. Here's what people are saying. Here's what my family is suggesting. And so I had to put biography, structure, history, all this stuff to really get an understanding of what's actually happening, right? And I see that as a scientific question. I see that as a personal question. I see that as a human question.
Last question. Is there one thing you wish non-sociologists knew about your field?
Yeah. One of the big misconceptions is that all we do is survey work. Another misconception is that we're all super empathetic and that we only study very small groups, right? Which is the complete opposite of, in some sense, epistemologically, scientifically, those sort of corners of sociology. And so in some sense, when you talk to your friendly neighborhood sociologist, you want to ask them about what kind of human relationships do you study and how do you study them? What's the takeaway from the kind of relationships that you've uncovered? And why is it meaningful to people? How long has that been going on? Those are the kinds of questions I think sociologists are really raring to answer, right? We do ask big questions about modern life. I would say we're the best at studying those things, and that we're sort of traditionally oriented towards those kinds of questions about how the entirety of our relationships, from the economy to politics to our families to our work lives, all of those are connected in the thing called society.
Celso M. Villegas, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you, Dan. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah.
This episode was recorded at the Wright Center in downtown Mount Vernon in the beautiful facilities of the Department of Dance, Drama, and Film. My thanks go to my editor and junior producer, Elizabeth Aduma, Kenyon Class of 2020, who recorded this episode, edited it, and made it sound professional. Thank you also to the Center for Innovative Pedagogy that funded this project and consulted on it since the beginning.